Hello everyone and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host Matt and welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? If you're like me, then the week ended on a bit of a rough note, but perseverance, right? All right, it's finally here, the long-awaited question show. I think you're going to see that based on at least one of the questions. I've been dragging my feet on this one a little bit just because of timing, but finally got my act together, sat down, looked over the questions, got to do some research, and I actually learned so much from this. So thank you to everyone who submitted questions. I learned. That's amazing. And they were great. I think you guys are going to enjoy this. Before we get to that, however, just a couple orders of business to take care of. First and foremost, if you are enjoying this podcast and you'd like to support it, please head on over to patreon.com/indefenseofplants and see what we got going on over there. For a little bit of money each month, you can get yourself kickbacks like stickers, access to the VIP section of the indefenseofplants.com website, which I just threw up a bunch of pictures on, by the way. And for those of you looking to give just a little bit more, you can even get yourself a producer credit on this show. For instance, today's episode is produced in part by Kevin, Katharina, Sophia, Brian, Mark, Sammy and Sven, Renz, Bendix, Arane, Holly, Clifton, Shane, Caitlin, Rosanna, Mary Jane, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, Sienna and Garth, Troy, Margie, and Laura. So thank you to everyone who's given thus far. It means so much to me, and every little bit helps. And again, the goal of In Defense of Plants here is to cure plant blindness one episode at a time, and with your help, we can do that. If a little bit of money each month isn't your thing, you can give a one-time donation of any amount. Just head on over to indefenseofplants.com, scroll down on the right-hand side of the page, and click that donate button. You can donate as little as 25 cents. Any little bit goes to the podcast, and it helps a ton. So thank you to everyone. I really couldn't be doing this without you. If money isn't your thing at all, which definitely understand that, at the very least, consider subscribing to and reviewing this podcast. And while you're at it, make a recommendation to at least two of your friends. I think other podcasters call those twofers. Reviews help the podcast not only become a better product for you, but they also help it reach a wider audience. And again, that whole goal is to introduce the world to the wonders of the botanical realm. And each review helps those recommendations reach potentially new listeners. So thank you to everyone who's given reviews thus far. If you've been listening to this for a while and you enjoy it and you got something you want to say or tell the world about it, please do that. Whatever podcatcher you use, just go over there, click subscribe, hit review, and then tell your friends about this podcast. All right, that's enough about business. Let's head on over to your questions. That's right, everyone. This is the question show. All right, before we get to the first question here, I just want to say that these are in no particular order. I didn't even put them in order of which they were received. I just threw them down, and whatever I found out first or did the research on just happened to take precedence here, so don't be offended if yours was fit in a different spot. It's no reflection on the question itself. Also, I'm sorry if I butcher anyone's names. I'm going to do my best here, but I apologize in advance. All right, first question comes from Stephen Rafici. Stephen asks, do flowers create more pollen and nectar when pollinators take what is present, or do they only have the amount they started with once the flower opens? This one was interesting, because it's something that I've kind of always just taken for granted, or at least had an idea in my head, but never really thought about, and it turns out the answer isn't straightforward. It's essentially as many variations as there are on flowers. There's lots of variation to go with that in how they distribute pollen and nectar. To the best of my knowledge, for most species, they do not create more pollen once it's been removed. The anthers mature, they have all the pollen they're going to contain, and when they open or dehisce or whatever it is they go through, that's the pollen available. This is even more true for species that have pollinia, like orchids and milkweeds. That's their only shot. So as soon as the pollinia have been removed from a flower, that was the male reproductive input for that flower. And with any luck, it might end up on a receptive female. But that's their last shot. Now, nectar, on the other hand, I do believe some species do replace nectar that has been withdrawn. This is especially true for longer flowering species and those that might be a little bit more pollen limited. But at the same time, there's plenty of plants that produce no nectar at all, and they're just there to fool insects into thinking that there's going to be a nectar reward. So again, this varies. Some do replace nectar, some don't replace the nectar, and some simply don't produce any at all. So I think it's all going to come down to which species you're interested in and what their pollination strategy is. A lot of this is going to be dictated by that, essentially the pollination syndrome and the behavior of whatever they've partnered with. So I hope that answers your question, Stephen. It's a little bit more complicated. We could probably do multiple episodes on pollen and nectar strategy. So, hey man, thanks for the idea. All right, so this next one gives you, again, a nice indication of how long I've been dragging my feet on this episode, because it takes us back to the eclipse, that wonderful, stunning eclipse, which I was very fortunate to be in Southern Illinois for, to see, you know, peak coverage of the sun. It was a remarkable experience, one I'm never going to forget, and just bizarre. But this next question is related to that, and it actually comes from someone who's been on the podcast a couple of times, Kristen Wickert. So Kristen asks, do we see signs of any eclipse in trees? And to be honest with you, I didn't think I was going to find anything relevant on this, just because eclipses are a very short part of what can be a very long life for a tree. I mean, if you figure, you know, some oaks can live, for instance, 300 to 400 years, no problem. A tiny eclipse on one day for a few minutes isn't really going to make or break, you know, it's not going to leave its mark on the tree itself. However, I did find a paper entitled Sap Flow Dynamics of a Beech Tree During the Solar Eclipse of August 11th, 1999. Now, the findings in this are not remarkable. They're not going to blow your mind. It's not like trees are responding heavily or have any real evolutionary adaptations to deal with eclipses. It's just not that strong of a selection pressure. But in the day-to-day sort of metabolism of trees, eclipses are something you can measure. So if you think about it, the sun's going away, the temperature is going to get a little bit cooler, especially if this is happening during the summer, a hot part of the summer especially. Cooler temperatures, lower evapotranspiration rates. Well, essentially what this paper found is that at the time of the maximum eclipse, the sap flow rates at the branch level and at the stem level were reduced by 92 and 76%. So as soon as it got dark, sap flow rates essentially more or less shut down, or a majority of it was kind of put on hiatus. At the same time, again, because the sun's going away, the heat's being reduced, the tree reduced its water loss from transpiration by 32 kilograms of water, being about 25% of the total amount which has transpired during a hot, sunny day in August. You know, from moment to moment, plants have to adjust to whatever their local conditions are, and eclipses are no different, I guess. You remove the sunlight, you remove the heat, and plants are going to respond accordingly. Whether or not that can translate to anything, any sort of long-term pattern, I don't think that's really a possibility. But if you would like to check out that paper, it is written by Kay Steep, Lemure, and Sampson. It's called Sap Flow Dynamics of a Beech Tree During Solar Eclipse of 11 August 1999. It was published in 2002 in the Journal of Agriculture and Forest Meteorology. Sounds like a fun journal. I'll have to check out more of their articles. Thanks, Kristen. I hope that answers your question. Okay, our next question comes to us from Corey Mosler. Corey writes, I know the fruits of the staghorn sumac, Rhus typhina, can be made into a tasty tea. Indeed they can. But how about the fruits of other species such as winged sumac, Rhus copalinum? And on that note, what other species of sumac are common in North America, and how are their fruits usually dispersed? Now, I'm not a wild edibles guy, I don't do much foraging, but I have had Rhus tea. To me, it kind of tastes like a much tangier version of pink lemonade, and I kind of like that about it. Apparently, all of the berries of the red Rhus species are edible, so if you have a species in the genus Rhus and it's producing red berries, here in North America, they're all edible. I can't speak to that genus elsewhere in the world. I do know my friend in Syria did mention that some of their Rhus species can be made into a delicious tea, so I'm guessing that pattern applies at least to some degree elsewhere in the world, but yes, if they are red on this continent, there's a good chance they're edible. Whether or not they make a good tea, I guess, is a matter of taste, and I've heard people complain about even staghorn sumac tea and other people that love it, so again, it's all to taste. I'm just going to put it out there that I do not endorse the consumption of anything that you don't know for sure is edible. I'd rather be cautious than dead or violently ill. But as far as common roosts are concerned, I guess it's all a matter of where you live. For instance, where I live right now in Illinois, staghorn smooth, winged, and aromatic sumac are all relatively common. Aromatic sumac, if you're going to see it in the wild, is usually on sandier soils, and it grows really low and looks a lot different than the other sumacs, so sometimes it can be hard to find it, but where I've seen it, it grows quite dense and does pretty well. Of course, if you've ever driven along a highway in the eastern United States, you see plenty of staghorn and smooth sumac. And, you know, where I work in North Carolina, winged sumac is pretty common alongside smooth as well. As far as I know, all the sumac are adapted for bird dispersal with those little berry type or drupes. I think they're drupes. And it's important to note that their drupes contain very little fats. They're mostly vitamins and trace minerals. There's not a lot of flesh and pulp in there. So they're more of a starvation food, which means that the berries are usually eaten later in the winter in temperate habitats after all the other more energy-rich food sources have been consumed. And that's not to say they're not important. They are vitally important for winter foraging birds, and especially those coming back after a long migration. You know, those berries being there throughout the winter and not having gone bad because of their low fat content is really important. And I've seen flocks of birds descend on patches of staghorn sumac and just go crazy on the berries in like February and early March. So despite how weedy some of these species are, they're very important for birds, and I think most of them are adapted for bird dispersal. So I hope that answers your question, Corey. That was a good one, and it kind of makes me want some staghorn sumac tea. Thank you again. All right, so this next one comes to us from Sean O'Donnell. Sean writes, "Where can I learn about the history of North American botanical exploration and the development of botanical science in North America? I've gobbled up several different sources on Enlightenment/Victorian-era histories of science with global foci from a European perspective. For example, Lane McCallum's Darwin's Armada, Jim Endersby's Imperial Nature, Kathy Willis and the BBC's Plants from Roots to Riches, great radio episode, as well as books written in those eras by practitioners of natural science, which encompass botany. So people like Humboldt and Darwin's Journal and Remarks, Wallace's Malay Archipelago, Bukhari's Wanderings of the Great Forests of Borneo, etc. Now Sean asks, have Gray and or Bartram and or any other natural historians, specifically botanists, written similar travelogues / popular science accounts, or are you aware of any good histories of North American botany? The nearest to this description that I've encountered is David Lee's edited compilation of David Fairchild's writings, The World as Garden. Thanks." All right, Sean, right off the bat, I don't read history books. I barely pick up biographies of people that I'm interested in. It's just not a realm I'm terribly fascinated in. That being said, for Bartram, you may want to try Mark Dion, Misadventures of a 21st Century Naturalist. That one's gotten good reviews. And then for an interesting review of the correspondence between Asa Gray and Charles Darwin, you can check out this paper. It's entitled Asa Gray and Charles Darwin, Corresponding Naturalists. It's by Harvard Papers in Botany. It's was published by Janet Brown in 2010. So go ahead and check that one out. But overall, I really don't read a lot of those types of books. I have no exposure to them. So if anyone listening has recommendations for Sean, write them down in the comments on this or write in. Send me an email, and I'll be sure to put those out into the world. Maybe I'll even give them a shot myself. Who knows? So thanks, Sean. You've kind of expanded my potential library with some of the recommendations that you just noted there, and maybe we'll get some more. But yeah, check out Mark Dion, Misadventures of a 21st Century Naturalist, and Asa Gray and Charles Darwin, Corresponding Naturalists by Janet Brown. Thanks for the question, Sean. Okay, this question comes to us from Matt Reese. Matt writes, "Epiphyllis, this concept has always baffled me. At school, I learned that if flowers are produced on a leaf-like structure, for example, ruscus and related genera, this structure is in fact not a leaf, but a stem, because that's where the buds and meristem are. In ruscus, the concept is easy to understand, because the venation of the leaf-like structure being parallel, and therefore resembling superficially a flattened stem. But in other groups, this is much less obvious. For instance, the genus Phyllonoma, which is the family Phyllonomaceae, Helwingia, which is from Helwingiaceae, both of these families come from the Aquifoliales, by the way, which that essentially means they're all related to hollies, Baselaria macropoda and Acanthaceae, and even Philobotryon and Salicaceae. The flower is produced on a leaf that really looks like a leaf. Moreover, the leaf is simple. I could kind of understand it if the leaf was compound and it modified its terminal leaflet or something like that, but not in these cases. How do these things evolve and in such different families slash orders? Matt, this was one heck of a question to research. I learned a lot about these plants, and simple answer is it's really hard to say how these things evolved. Unless there's a very clear selective pressure on these types of evolutionary adaptations, it's really hard. It's anyone's guess. You can make some informed opinions, but luckily there have been some people out there trying to kind of get their heads wrapped around this idea. So for the person listening that hasn't quite picked up on it yet, epiphyllous means flowers being produced on a leaf instead of in the axils of a leaf or on a stem of their own or right off the stem of the trunk, as we see in like redbud, for instance. This is an extremely rare phenomenon in the plant kingdom, and I think it's actually largely occurring in tropical genera. And they're actually very pretty. If you can Google some of the species I just mentioned, it's a pretty interesting adaptation, and it just looks weird to see a flower coming off of a leaf-like structure. As Matt mentioned, ruscus, they're not actual leaves, they're flattened portions of the stem, functioning much in the same way as leaves. So yes, this is a rare phenomenon in the plant kingdom, and one possible scenario is through what they call ectopic formation of shoot meristems on the leaves. And what that really means is that the meristem tissue, which is like stem cells, undifferentiated stem cells in plants, which can then form the different organs, get pushed out from the shoot onto the leaves. And then they would just go on to develop much in the same way they would on the stem, but this time they're happening on the leaves. Clark and others demonstrated this on tissue-cultured plants, where there was an overexpression of shoot meristem genes. So this is ex situ in culture, messing around with the genes of a plant. You can actually, induce shoot meristem genes in the leaf and get flowers to develop on the leaf. So maybe something like that is happening in the wild. The plants you have mentioned really are producing flowers on their leaves, though, except for ruscus. I think they are all considered leaves, for real. They're not flattened stem structures. They are true leaves. In the case of Helwingia japonica, this is because the inflorescence primordium that formed originally on the shoot apex gets carried up with the growth of the leaf. So when everything is very small and still in its bud-like form, that primordia, or those pre-floral buds, developed on the stem, but as the leaf developed, they dragged up along with the leaf itself, and then they develop the rest of the way on the actual leaves themselves. Now, as far as a selective advantage is concerned, it may be a novel trait related to growth on poor soils. This is through someone named D. Thomas has suggested that. So perhaps it's just using organs that are already there instead of going through the energy necessarily or the process of development in producing an entirely separate organ. That was through a personal communication, and it was like maybe a line in the paper. So that is still very hypothetical at this point. I don't think you can really say that for sure. According to a 1974 review paper by Dickinson and Sattler, however, they said that, and I quote, "It may be likely that given the morphogenic opportunity to display flowers and fruits upon leaves rather than on stems, a plant may do so as long as it does not adversely affect its reproductive functioning." So essentially, if it's not hurting the plant and it happens, there's really no selective pressure to go away from it. And perhaps if enough have evolved along those lines, then you have a species that does that regularly. Now, such an event could occur directly as the product of a mutation leading only to epiphyllia, or it could be the adaptively neutral byproduct of the effect of natural selection on an unknown aspect of the plant's reproductive biology. And that's from Stebbins in 1968, essentially saying the same thing. If it happens through a mutation or via an accident and there's really no disadvantage to it, why not? It's not always about strong selection pressures. A lot of mutations can be neutral, and if it may incur an advantage on some other trait and it just happened to get carried along through something like pleiotropy, then why not? And the plant just goes on doing things without experiencing any reduction in reproductive benefit. Now, finally, epiphylly could have been selected for as an alternative strategy for the optimal presentation of flowers to pollinators. And this is from Ganong in 1901 has suggested that, Stebbins again in 1972. And that way they are transferring the display function to an organ already present. And that's from Korner in 1958. And essentially, as I said earlier, they could be taking this display idea, something that large flowers are usually known for. You can reduce the flower size and stick them on an organ, such as a leaf that's already there. Maybe not investing as much in floral displays and certainly keeping them on an organ that's already been made goes back to this energy saving idea. And it could be that, you know, epiphytes or terrestrial plant species growing in nutrient poor conditions, that's just a much better way of displaying your flowers rather than putting all that energy into large petals and fragrances and stuff. Why not just use a flag post that you already made and is giving you some photosynthetic benefit in the long run? So Matt, I hope that tickles enough of your curiosity there. I wish I had more of a concise answer for you. That one was a fun one to research because, honestly, I hadn't seen most of those species in person before, so Googling them alone just to look at them and the way their flowers are displayed, that was really fun. So thanks for that question. That was great, and you got me thinking about epiphyllous plants now. Way to go. Okay, now this one, I had to pull in a lot of lines of expertise to get to the bottom of this. And I learned so much from this question. I love phylogenetic trees of life. I love learning about the relationship and origin of major clades. So this one was a great question. This one comes from Alex Staunch. And Alex writes, am I correct in my uneducated assumption that monocots are more prevalent in diversity, abundance, and biomass in aquatic environments in comparison to terrestrial habitats? If monocots are more prevalent in aquatic systems, why is this so? What are the adaptations and evolutionary history that lead to this? So the first person I reached out to was Dr. Colette Giacono from the University of Florida. She's an aquatic plant specialist and really knowledgeable. And she said that off the cuff and considering primarily herbaceous communities, she would say, no, monocots are not more prevalent in aquatic habitats than they are terrestrial habitats. And she says, think of the dominance of grasses and sedges in so many upland habitats. Overall, plasticity to a changing environment, not just the evolution of particular morphological or morphophysiological adaptations, is primary for success in the aquatic environment. And when I think of particularly plastic species, I tend towards dicots. So essentially, in her opinion, she thinks the adaptations necessary for those kinds of rapid changes in both being above and below water, changing water levels over periods of time, and even light levels, she would think dicots might be a little bit more successful in those habitats and being predisposed to more plastic. The aquatic habitat, she says, has been an acquired trait in many cases. In other words, terrestrials have always returned to water. So Colette gave us something to think about. Now, another thing to think about, I think it's important distinction to make here is, are we talking fully aquatic plants? Are we talking submersed plants? Are we talking emergent plants? Are we talking floating plants? You know, this definition of aquatic isn't always as straightforward as many might think so, and there's a lot of different strategies. Going back to what Colette had said about, you know, just being able to deal with a variety of conditions, especially if you live in an aquatic situation where it dries up throughout the year, or, you know, in most cases where you need to flower above the waterline to successfully achieve reproduction. Remember, we're talking about flowering plants here. Now, I wanted to take this much further than this. I found a paper from Zi Yuan and others from 2015, and it's the phylogenetic tree of vascular plants reveals origins of aquatic angiosperms. Now they write that aquatic plants are phylogenetically well dispersed across the angiosperms. So whether that's monocot, eudicot, or whatever the, you know, paleoherbs, there are plenty of representatives of aquatic lifestyles in those with at least 50 independent origins. So aquatic plants have independently evolved, you know, in different lineages. I'm not talking about a lineage that went into the water and then diversified. There's been at least 50 independent going from land to water throughout the history of flowering plants. But in total, they comprise less than 2% of the angiosperm species. Now, angiosperms really started to colonize the water around the late Mesozoic period. And it's believed that there's a good potential that some angiosperm ancestors may have tried to escape competition and crowding on land by moving into kind of peripheral aquatic habitats and then eventually adapting to, in some cases, a fully aquatic lifestyle. They say that the early appearance of aquatic angiosperms supports the view that early angiosperms had a growth habit of rhizomatous herbs, which could be easily transformed into aquatic habit. So essentially, these early rhizomatous species might have done a little bit better than something like a bulbous species would have in transferring their lifestyle into an aquatic situation. Because of their rhizomatous growth habit and efficient seedlings, these herbaceous species invaded their aquatic habitats in the early Cretaceous. So early angiosperm fossils that are near basal phylogenetic position on the botanical tree of life of many aquatic orders actually suggests that aquatic habits arose early. So pretty much as soon as most of the early angiosperm lineages came on board, they were already adapting to a watery lifestyle. Now, whether their extinct ancestors of these early aquatic lineages were fully aquatic or terrestrial remains entirely unclear. Again, I think one of the predominating views is, at least for eudicots, that every one of them in aquatic habitats has a terrestrial ancestor. But I don't know if that's the case for monocots because of something that has come out repeatedly over the last few decades. And this is the idea that monocots may be relics of an early radiation of herbaceous angiosperms to aquatic environments. Orders, we're talking the stage of taxonomic hierarchy above family. So orders such as Acorales, Elismateles are successive sister groups to the remaining monocots. So they branched off really early in the monocot evolutionary tree and have been going on their own ever since then. Acorales is distributed widely in north temperate wetlands, and Elismateles is globally distributed in the aquatic environments. Essentially saying that if these two early lineages are predominantly aquatic, then there's a chance, or at least there's a line of school of thought, that maybe monocots had aquatic origins, and then that would have been followed by gradual evolution to adapt to terrestrial environments. And this hypothesis of the aquatic origin of monocots is actually pretty consistent with the fossil records that we currently have. So another person I had to confer with is taxonomist and author of The Flora of Middle Earth, Dr. Walter Judd. And Dr. Judd says that the aquatic origin for monocots is a very plausible hypothesis, given the wet affinities of a lot of taxa, including, as we talked about just a minute ago, the basal Acorales. But without a good fossil record, it's hard to be certain. So despite a handful of fossils, apparently we need much more resolution to say for sure. One cautionary tale on the lability of vegetative traits is the repeated evolution of broad net vein leaves in monocots whenever they inhabit shady environments. So essentially what that is saying is that I think these broad net vein leaves in monocots are often associated with an aquatic habit, but if you're looking at purely the fossil record and you're looking at these net veins, you can't necessarily say that they were from an aquatic habit. And he gives the example of the genus Trillium and the genus Paris. Both of those are monocots with this net-like venation in their leaves, but that's an adaptation to shaded habitats, not aquatic habitats. So it's kind of hard to say for sure without direct evidence of them being aquatic plants themselves. So I don't know if we answered your question here. I can't say for sure. It doesn't seem like anyone can say for sure that there's more monocots in aquatic habitats than others. There is a fair amount of evidence and enough of a school of thought in the peer-reviewed literature to say that monocots might have actually arose in aquatic or at least semi-aquatic habitats and then later adapted to land, but we need much more resolution in the fossil record before we can say that for sure. I do know that when you talk about early angiosperms and the whole fossil record, and especially when you talk about fossil findings like Archaefructus, you know, the adaptations for living in water are often very derived. That being said, I'm not much of a physiologist or a paleobotanist, so I can't say that with any certainty, but I hope we've kind of answered your question here. That was a great question. It got me again thinking about the phylogenetic tree of life and the evolution of major lineages, and that's one I think I'm going to keep my eye on as things developed. It's a fascinating realm of inquiry, and I got my start in aquatic plants because I was growing planted aquariums, but I've never really given them the attention they deserve. So if anything, you've got me thinking a lot more about aquatic plants. So thank you, Alex. I hope we answered your question satisfactorily. All right, last but not least, and I mean that, last but not least, this question comes to us from Rose Bear. And Rose asks that, I noticed that you and a lot of the guests on your show are practicing professional botanists. What career path does one follow to end up in that sort of job, especially one with fieldwork? I would love to have the sort of job you and many other guests have, but I'm not sure how to get there. Well, Rose, to Clarify, I am not a botanist, especially not a practicing professional botanist. I've actually had very little formal botanical training. Most of what I've done is just learning in my spare time. Unfortunately, botany isn't the career path it once was. It's not the science it once was. It used to get much more prominence in journals and in scientific conferences and conversations, but today it's been, or for the last few decades at least, it's been kind of shunned as not being big enough in its scope, not having enough theory to test, which is a real shame. I think botany and any of the specific organismal scientists are probably some of the most important sciences we could be doing because it teaches us how individual organisms and thus biodiversity are responding to everything that's ever happened and anything that's ever going to happen. Plus, it's just fascinating. So I'm definitely not a practicing professional botanist. Many of the people I interview actually are not technically botanists. Most of us are all ecologists, which is not a bad thing. I like to think of it as a botanist with ecologist clothing. And ecology is the study of interactions of organisms, and plants don't operate in a vacuum, so ecology offers a lot of wonderful things to explore and has a lot of applications for restoring and protecting sensitive and dwindling habitat types, something we desperately need in this future. But in terms of career path advice, I don't know if I'm necessarily the perfect person to answer this or even a good person to answer this because my route has been kind of circuitous. But essentially what you're going to want to do is get a strong foundation in biology. You know, at the bachelor's level as an undergrad, you are not going to become a botanist. No one is. And that's a big thing for people to wrap their head around. You're just not getting the kind of specialized training at the undergrad level to become a botanist. That's not to say you can't go on to have jobs in that field with a bachelor's degree, but it makes it a lot more difficult. But what you really want to do is set your foundation in biology because plants are living, breathing organisms that have biology, and a lot of the principles that you learn in classes like biology, cell biology, geology, chemistry, especially organic chemistry, and even physics can be applied and are much needed foundations for being a better scientist later on. So I would say at the undergraduate level, if that's the option you want to take, you don't need to go to college for this. You know, you can read books on your own time. But at the undergraduate level, which I think if you want to get a job, you're eventually going to have these degrees, you know, get a strong foundation in biology and internship and volunteer. I can't emphasize that enough. I think that's the number one thing that helped me out, and it's the only thing that's going to set you apart because we are sending so many people to college that it's harder and harder to seem more unique. So you really want to set yourself apart. Volunteer in labs, a variety of labs. Don't just pick botanically focused labs. You want to know what kind of work you like to do. You know, lab work may sound appealing. It may be really cool sounding to run gels and count nematodes on a tray, but until you do it, you don't know if you like it. And it would be really sad to kind of gear yourself up for something like that, commit to a long-term degree program or job program, and then realize you hate it. So volunteer in a variety of labs and get yourself in on some undergraduate research opportunities. I can't emphasize that enough either. If you show that you want to do research and you want to be committed to this cause that early on, you're going to stand out so much later on. Not a lot of undergrads do that, so it's not that hard to stand out. And there's a lot of cool projects you can work on. So it all depends on what the academic situation is in your area. If academia at this level is not for you, I would recommend grabbing textbooks. I don't think people consider that enough. Grabbing old versions of textbooks that are really, really cheap is not a bad way to teach yourself some basic biology, botany, or any science for that matter. If you get ones that have been released in the last, you know, decade or less, they're really not going to be terribly out of date, and the bigger principles you're going to get from them are all very applicable. So grab some old textbooks, grab some just fun reading books that are science-oriented. Botany in a Day is a great place to start. If you want to get into botany, it teaches you the terms. Get an illustrated glossary of botanical terms because it really, you know, to kind of understand plants and talk about them and properly identify them, you almost need to learn a different language, and that's the language of botanical terms. And those can be really hard to commit to memory. I don't even do that. But if you get an illustrated glossary of the terms, it at least puts a physical appearance behind the name, and it helps you learn them a lot better. And then once you get that, get some field guides, get some keys, go out into your neighborhood and learn the plants. That's one of the most important things that you could do that people really forget is just learn the plants, get to know them, learn their scientific names. And then once you know a scientific name, you can do research on that plant and learn so much more about it. Now, at this point, I will say that because of the job market, the odds of anyone really getting into a long-term career path without a degree or with just a bachelor's degree is very slim. I can't lie to you, the job market for these things is dismal, and in a lot of ways, it's only going to get worse. That's not to say jobs aren't out there, but you're going to want to give yourself a little bit of a leg up. And I think, you know, if you want botany or ecology or something plant-related to be your career, that is where getting your master's degree comes in. That was the biggest step I ever took in my education, and I'm really happy I did it. I personally love grad school. I don't find it to be as stressful or as terrible as an environment as a lot of people make it out to me, but I'm different. It may not be the career path you want to take, but if you do decide to do that, the master's level is where you start to specialize. That's not to say the master's level locks you in, but you're going to want to pick a lab, first and foremost, with a person you can work with. Your advisor is everything. It's the guiding light through the entire program, and if you don't like that person, it can be a miserable experience. So before you even decide to go into a botany lab, find an advisor that you think you can work with. Preferably pick a field of science that you want to work in, but at the master's level, you're just proving that you, with some guidance, can do science, and it's not, you know, a ball and chain into the rest of your life. It's just proving that you can do science. So pick an advisor that you like to work with in a program that interests you and work together to create a project that you think you can accomplish in a few short years. Don't be a hero. You're not going to change the world with a master's degree. Do a nice, concise project because the skills you learn are far more important than the content that's coming out. And that may seem crass or harsh to say, but you want to develop analytical skills. You want to develop a skill set that shows you can be trusted to go out into the field and do science. And as you suggested here, you know, you want something with field work. And at that point, you know, I would suggest looking at different programs, you know, out west, any sort of seasonal positions. That's where the funnest jobs are the seasonal positions. They don't offer a lot of stability, and within 3 to 6 months, you're moving on to something else. But my CV would not be where it is today. I don't think I would be where I am today without seasonal work. And those jobs can be great. It's an opportunity to travel, get paid a little bit, and just see an incredible things. I mean, the out west, it's much easier to get jobs because there's so much more federal land. But start applying to federal agencies. Start applying to land conservancies. You know, look for field jobs. Anything that says there's a field component. If it's not even a plant-focused job, oftentimes vegetation surveys are part of that. There's also consulting firms. There's a lot more jobs in consulting firms, I think, for environmental work today than there are federal jobs, I think. That's definitely not necessarily true, but that's just my gauge on the environment out there. But get those jobs. Do a bunch of them. Bounce around for a while. Learn what you like, learn what you don't like. Learn the kind of regions you can work in and the kind of regions you can't stand. Those not only help you grow as a person, they give you experience and you get to see so many great things. I can't emphasize that enough. And then from there, you decide where you want to go. Unfortunately, you know, with most careers, the higher you move up on the platform, the less field work you're going to be doing, but that's not always the case. But I hope that helps. I mean, get books. Just start reading. Familiarize yourself with the language. Start talking like a botanist. Just know plants. Grow them. Find them. Identify them. Get to know them. Because if you start to understand how to talk about them and you can portray that passion, people will see that in you. And that's how you get jobs. I hope that helps. I mean, I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm still in grad school. I don't really have a job other than doing research at this point. And that's not going to last forever. And I don't know what's going to happen after this. So I'm still trying to figure it out too. But for the better or for worse, if you really think botany or, you know, botanical ecology is where you want to go, get some books, start learning, and then look at courses you can take. You know, it's a sad truth that people want to see that piece of paper. They want to see that diploma, and oftentimes you got to jump through the hoops to get the kind of work you want. So there's a lot of options out there, and I wish you all the best. I really do. It's really fun. I absolutely love this field. It's never going to pay you very much, but that's not what it's about. So best of luck to you, Rose. Thanks for the question. I think a lot of other people have the same question and just didn't write it in. So I appreciate that. All right. That's it. That's the question show. Thank you so much to everyone who submitted questions. I learned a ton in researching this. I really appreciate it. I hope everyone enjoyed it. We'll do one of these again sometime. I'm not going to say soon. Obviously, it took me a while to get around to this one, but we'll do this again sometime. So pay attention. The best way to pay attention is to hit subscribe. Before I let you go, indefensiveplants.com/shop. Go pick up a sticker or two. They're great gifts for people. They look amazing. They're designed by Tom Pearson Designs. And every purchase that you make, 50% is getting donated to orchid conservation efforts here in North America. Also, patreon.com/indefensiveplants if you'd like to support this podcast with a little monetary input each month. At the very least, consider subscribing to, reviewing, and recommending this podcast to others. And last but not least, youtube.com/indefensiveplants. Go check out our videos. We got some exciting things in the video world in the works, so stay tuned for that. Also, great episodes coming up in the next couple of weeks. I'm really excited for my guests, so stay tuned. All right, everyone. This is Matt, your host, signing out. Adios.